Unlock the power of your mind. This is Provocative Enlightenment with Eldon Taylor.
Welcome, and thank you for joining us today. This is an hour devoted to learning something more, not just about the world of shoes and ships and sealing wax, but about how, what, and why we think and believe as we do. An hour for the open-minded, willing to challenge some of those old ideas behind what we think we know, who we are, and who we might become. I'm Eldon Taylor, and this is Provocative Enlightenment. All right, our chat room is open, and my partner Ravinder awaits you there now. You can log on by going to eldontaylor.com/chat. So, Ravinder, say hello to everyone and tell us all about your chat room.
Well, hello, everyone. Everyone knows about the chat room. It's the only place to be. It's eldontaylor.com/chat, where the chat's always very lively, very educational, and inspirational.
All right. Every week I read some of your letters as our way of paying respect to the very important role you play in making this show successful. Last week, Ravinder and I took our very first vacation in almost 25 years. Actually, I suppose, my pretty bride wanted to call it our delayed honeymoon. Right, Rev?
That's right. We had to cancel our honeymoon when it was supposed to be because we got busy. We got busy with business, and you kept me busy for 20 years. So I finally got my honeymoon.
Okay. All right. So anyway, last week our show was a replay of the delightfully illuminating conversation we had with Dr. Karen Wyatt. Todd wrote, "I missed the original broadcast of the Wyatt Show and I almost didn't tune into it because it was a replay. I am really glad that I did listen. This was one of the best shows I have heard and at a time when I needed it. I think you have to be there to really appreciate Dr. Wyatt's message. Thank you." Well, you're more than welcome, Todd, and I too found Karen's message very powerful, and you might want to watch our show schedule because she's working on some new material and we'll be bringing her back in the near future. Moving on, Lori wrote, "I just love your show, and hearing you and your wife inspires me in my marriage." Now that's sweet. That's nice.
That's cool.
Okay, I like that. Sandy wrote, "I just want to tell you what a blessing you and Ravinder are to me. I listen to you on Hay House Radio Weekly and always get so much out of the program. Love and light to you both." Well, and right back at you, Sandy. Would you like to add anything to that, Rev?
I just think it's wonderful. I like, we have a special relationship and I really like it that other people see that and can learn from it because we're always learning anyway.
All right. That's a fact. Okay, Jacob wrote, "Thank you for your show. It's my favorite on Hay House Radio." I like that one. Thank you, Jacob. Michelle wrote, "I have been reading a wonderful book by Eldon Taylor titled I Believe When What You Believe Matters. This book has been a true gift to me lately." Taylor wrote, "Love your work. Self-hypnosis and subliminal technology is well written, easily relatable, and understandable. The exercises really work. I have always had a very tough time with meditation and or relaxation due to the high volume of thoughts and past memories overriding the present moment. Your relaxation exercises allowed me to let go and just be in the state of bliss. Thank you." Now, there's two comments by Michelle and Taylor and about two of my favorite books, and I'd love to hear from each and every one of you when you've read them. So, you know, send me a letter. Let me know what you think of them, huh? Sadat wrote, "I just wanted to stop by and say I may occasionally post a thank you on your page because I have been using your CDs for many years now, since I discovered them around 2005. I didn't use them as much in the past as I do now because I was at a different level of awareness and knowledge on the subjects of metaphysics, hypnosis, subliminal communication, the subconscious mind, etc. I have a collection of over 30 of your CDs and many of your books. I am comfortable saying on behalf of everyone who has benefited from your work that we appreciate you immensely and look forward to what the future holds. Thank you, sir." Well, thank you, Sadat, for your feedback and comments, and here's to your continued success in your every endeavor. And thank you, Princess, because, you know, this is a lot of people give me the credit, but behind the, you know,
behind the scenes, I'm washing the bottles and scrubbing the floors.
No. Yeah. Cute, real cute. Anne-Marie wrote, I used your stress-free MP3 and it has helped me tremendously. Melissa wrote, thank you, Eldon, for the downloads. You are a precious spirit. Sophie wrote, I am so grateful you have some free MP3s to download. It's nice to see a company that is not all about greed. Now, Melissa and Sophie are both referring to the free MP3 programs that we make available. These are not samples. They are the real deal, the patented and scientifically proven InterTalk technology. We think of this as just a part of our own pay it forward efforts. So why wait? Go get yours today. There are several titles just waiting to be downloaded. True Trained Mindfulness. Just a click away. Visit InterTalk, InnerTalk.com and choose free programs from the left-hand navigation pane. It doesn't get easier, does it?
No.
No. That no is right. Okay, that's all the time we're going to take for letters today. We can't get all of your remarks on the air, but I want you to know your comments definitely impact our programming. I invite you to opine by sending your email to Eldon@EldonTaylor.com or by joining me on Facebook. And once again, we both appreciate and thank you for your feedback and continued support. Now to today's show, Medusa of Time, How Technology Redefines Copenhagen. Now, most of you probably know of the mythical being Medusa. Once very beautiful, she was cursed by Athena. The story goes something like this. Medusa sought to visit the south, so she asked Athena for permission. Athena refused to allow her to visit. The Medusa got angry and dared to say that Athena refused the permission because she was jealous of Medusa's beauty. Scorn women, watch out. Athena was angered and punished her by turning her hair into snakes and cursing her by making her so ugly that whoever looked upon her eyes would turn into stone. All right. Now, Copenhagen, in the context of our title, refers to what is known in physics as the Copenhagen interpretation. Quoting Wiki, it holds that quantum mechanics does not yield a description of an objective reality, but deals with probabilities of observing or measuring various aspects of energy quanta, entities that fit neither the classical idea of particles nor the classical idea of waves. According to the interpretation, the act of measurement causes the set of probabilities to immediately and randomly assume one of the possible values. This feature of the mathematics is known as wave function collapse. The essential concepts of the interpretation were devised by Niels Bohr, Werner Heisenberg, and others back in 1920, between 24 and 27. So what on earth does Medusa and Copenhagen have in common? Or how do they relate, if at all? We'll ask our guest that today because he wrote the book, Medusa of Time, How Technology Redefines Copenhagen. His blurb describing this work states, quote, which reality are we to believe? Our minds and logic tell us that the world in which we live is real. It's concrete. It's particulate. We can see it, touch it, taste it, smell it, and hear it. Science, on the other hand, suggests something else. Our minds may be deceiving us. The world, when we are not observing it, is totally different. We have always believed, when we closed our eyes or slept, that the world maintained its basic shape and substance. That is, things would be essentially the same when we woke up as when we went to sleep. The Copenhagen interpretation tells us, however, that this simple assumption is not necessarily the case. When the world sleeps, our universe may transform into a non-material fairyland of ghostly waves and electromagnetic energy. Nothing is real as we know it anymore. Yet when we awake, everything is just as we left it, or is it? Are my car keys really where I left them last night? The Copenhagen interpretation may explain why we can't locate those mischievous keys. Specifically, it states that up until the time of observation, my car keys exist as a host of probabilities, as waves, including the possibility that they are now 2 inches, 2 feet, or even 2 miles from their last observed location. Close quote. Our guest today has been with us before when we discussed his work and book, How Science Proves There Is an Afterlife. Dr. T. Lee Bauman, M.D., is the author of a dozen books. Dr. Bauman has appeared in the documentaries The Evidence for Heaven and The Search for Heaven. He is also the author of God at the Speed of Light, The Melding of Science and Spirituality, Window to God, A Physician's Spiritual Pilgrimage, and The Akashic Light, Religion's Common Thread, to list but a few. Dr. Bauman's copy reads, beginning his spiritual journey as a religious skeptic in the 1970s, Dr. Bauman now writes books defending spirituality based upon the incredible link between worldwide descriptions of God and the proven scientific nature of physical light. Close quote. All right. Dr. Bauman is a medical consultant in Birmingham, Alabama. In addition to his years in private practice, he has been a medical administrator and a biology instructor. Let's get the man in here. Welcome back to Provocative Enlightenment, Dr. T. Lee Bauman.
Well, hi, Eldon and Ravinder. It's a pleasure, as always, to be on your broadcast. And before I lose track, I want to congratulate you on finally having your honeymoon.
Yeah, you believe that? 25 years. Okay.
That is a long time.
Yeah, she's a patient woman, isn't she?
She must be a real blessing.
That is indeed a truth. That's a fact. Dr. Bauman, before we get into your work, I understand that 100% of the proceeds from the sales of all your books go towards your 32 God at the Speed of Light college scholarship endowments in Alabama, Mississippi, Illinois, and Cape Town, South Africa. So if we can, let's begin by having you flesh this out for us some. What are the endowments in honor of, and why did you create them?
Eldon, I am so glad you brought that up, because this is a part of my life which is so important to me. I have always been a firm believer of the educational process, and I felt what a better way to give back to all the blessings and good fortune that I and my family have than to endow these college scholarships for financially needy students. The endowments are unrestricted, so it doesn't have to be, you know, within the field of science. It can be art or literature or whatever. But yes, I have endowed them throughout the Southeast. And last year, when I did a month of volunteering in Cape Town, South Africa, I was so overwhelmed with the good nature and humility of the South Africans that I investigated establishing some scholarships at the University of Cape Town as well. And I just feel so blessed and privileged to be able to do that.
Well, I think that speaks very highly of you, Dr. Bauman, of your character and your intent. And this is 100% of the proceeds that you get from the sale of your books that go to this.
It is. I've been blessed having spent my past as a physician, and I feel that this is something which is very easy for me to do. But then again, I have been blessed in my past. So finances are not something which has stricken me over the past several decades, and I've been fortunate that that has been the case. And this is just a very wonderful way that I can give back.
Indeed it is. And, you know, before we get into the books, I'm just going to say there's a dozen of them at Amazon. I have several of them myself. I think I have 8 of them now. And none of them are disappointing. And so if you... all of our listeners out there, if you wanted to have a good read, you could just about pick any of them, including the book that we're going to be talking about today, Medusa of Time. And at the same time, know that the money that you're putting out on this book is going to help, you know, young people who need that help in obtaining the education that's necessary to deal with life as we know it today.
Exactly. All right. Thank you for bringing that up, Eldon.
Indeed. Let's go to Medusa of Time. You heard the setup piece. Why this title, and what do you intend to be implied by it?
Right. First of all, there are two important items as an introduction. For me, It has always been science or nothing. I was actually raised as a Christian by my parents, and as I was going through my pre-medical education between the science behind medicine and the science behind astronomy and the Big Bang and whatnot, I was really convinced that there was no need for a divine creator within the universe. You know, the Big Bang explained how the universe came to be, theory of evolution described why we're here, basically. And so probably 30-some years ago, I felt there was no need for a God. So I am your ultimate skeptic. And yet, what happened was back in the mid-1970s, I found some very supernatural elements in some books that I was reading at the time. One was books on Einstein's special theory of relativity, where it appeared that physical light, the photon, seemed to have some very convincing supernatural characteristics. And so I continued my research into physical light and indeed found that, you know, this was the case. And I know we'll be discussing that later in the hour. The second item is that this particular book, Medusa of Time, is a purely quantum physics book. I discuss almost minimally any type of spiritual relationship. But having said that, your listeners should know that quantum physics was one of the main fields of study that actually converted me back into being a believer in God. So even though this is a purely quantum physics book, it does have, I think, some very supernatural ramifications to it. Now, Medusa, as you so eloquently put it in the opening remarks, is that this lady, whenever anyone looks at her, they are turned to stone. Interestingly, is that the Copenhagen interpretation in quantum physics basically states the same is true for whenever we observe anything within our current reality. And again, we'll be getting into the details of that. This is not an easy subject matter to grasp, so I will probably be struggling at many times during the course of the next hour trying to communicate my thoughts in understandable terms. Your listeners can probably appreciate that from the excerpt you read from Wikipedia on the Copenhagen interpretation, because after 30 years of study, I could barely understand what that meant.
Right.
You know, these are deep, deep concepts, so they're not always easy to understand.
Okay, but now since you brought that up, you know, I'm going to have to ask you the tough question, okay?
Perfect.
I recently shared a poll on my Facebook page that showed clearly physicists, you know, the experts, disagree over the meaning of quantum mechanics and everything that's implied. Indeed, the Bohr versus Einstein argument is still so unsettled that according to this poll, only 42% of the respondents favored Bohr's Copenhagen interpretation. But that said, 64% insisted that Einstein's view was fundamentally incorrect, too. Now, I've got the poll here. So quoting the poll, it says, ultimately, those polled were so divided they couldn't even agree on whether similar conferences on quantum foundations would take place 50 years from now. Close quote. So in other words, they're so divided, they don't think in 50 years they're going to have a consensus of opinion. So now my question. Given that the experts disagree as much as they do on the nature of our world, are you at all concerned that your interpretations may prove to be entirely false?
Oh, not at all. In fact, I fully expect that over the next several decades that there are going to be elements that will be proven to be false. Fortunately for me, that is not going to be able to alter my own inherent spirituality, because I feel the main concepts which converted me have been so strongly proven that that is not a personal concern.
So that aspect of what you're going to share with our audience, you feel to be what? Immutable.
Well, not 100% of them, because I'm not naive to that degree, because, you know, the only consistent thing in history is its inconsistency.
True.
So no, I think, you know, there will probably be points over the next several decades that will be disproven, but the basic concepts, I feel, have been so integrated through science and proven through scientific experimentation that at least the main ingredients that have converted me into a spiritual person, I feel those are pretty solid.
All right, let's just jump in there. Let's grab a bottom line question then, right from the get-go.
Sure.
Why is it that human observation appears, emphasis on appears, to cause the collapse of the enigmatic wave function of quantum mechanics? And if it is not the observation itself that is the causal factor, what is?
Right. Again, perfect question. By the way, I do want to back up just for a moment.
Sure.
And say that it doesn't bother me in the least that physicists disagree. From my knowledge of physics, which the way the state of the art currently stands, to me it would make total sense that every physicist should believe in God, and yet they don't. And the fact that they disagree is no different in the field of physics than it was in my practice of medicine, where doctors never agree. So what we find is that when that occurs, you recommend to your patients that they go and get second, maybe even third opinions, because that is just the state of the art, and that's human nature.
Right.
So again, that doesn't surprise me, but to answer your question, how does human observation cause waves to collapse into particles, which is basically what the Copenhagen interpretation is talking about? It's a very complex subject, and I think we need to start from the standpoint that if we start with the photon, the light wave or the light particle, which is probably the most studied particle wave in, you know, the history of physics,
right.
that would be probably the best place to start. What physicists have found...
I think we've lost Dr. Bauman. The studio will get him back on the telephone while we're waiting for Dr. Bauman to rejoin us. Some of the ideas, some of the questions that I'm going to ask him, I will put out there to the chat room so you can start cogitating on this. You know, if we have the Copenhagen principle here, the waveform collapses when it's observed, how does that fit into the holographic paradigm that we hear so many talking about and evidencing as, you know, a modern physical interpretation that supports the idea of a spiritual universe? Or how does that fit into the many worlds argument or the string theory proponents, et cetera? I think we have Dr. Bauman back. Do we not, sir? Are you there, Dr. Bauman?
I am here. Can you hear me?
I can. We dropped you for a minute, and I was just picking up, suggesting some questions I may put forward to you in a minute. But we're coming up on a hard break, so
yeah.
Go ahead, and I may have to cut you off.
No, that is perfectly fine. I was talking about the wave function collapse and the study of the photon. In the past, physicists have noted that whenever we measured the speed of light,
okay, I'm sorry. I am going to have to cut you off there.
Yes,
we'll pick up on photons and the speed of light when we get back. We're speaking with Dr. T. Lee Bauman about the physics of our world and his book, Medusa of Time, How Technology Redefines Copenhagen. Remember, 100% of the proceeds go to supporting children and their college education. If you're not already in our chat room, now's a great time to join in the conversation. We have a short film about the Higgs field and Higgs boson, and we'll be talking about that later in the show. Do stay tuned. You don't want to miss what's coming up after a few words from some of our friends.
Unlock the power of your mind. This is Provocative Enlightenment with Eldon Taylor.
And welcome back. If you just joined us, we're speaking with Dr. T. Lee Bauman about the physics of our world and his book, Medusa of Time. But before we get back to the show, I want to invite you to join me on Facebook. I post regularly everything from where I am and what's on next to the latest in science, technology, and consciousness studies. And from time to time, some of my own opinions about the world we live in. I would also like to remind you to be sure and sign up for my free newsletter when you visit my website and get your free MP3. All right, let's get back to the show. Dr. Bauman, before the break, we have got a lot to cover in just, you know, the next half hour, so I'm going to let you just go. Before the break, we were talking about photons. Pick it up, please.
All right, thank you, Eldon. Yes. We were talking about the wave function collapse, which is basically defined in quantum physics about literal waves, such as light waves, collapsing into light particles. Now, physicists know that whenever we measure a light wave, we measure its speed at 186,000 miles per second. So we have a definite speed for light. Now, at the same time, Einstein's special theory of relativity, which again has been proven multiple times over and over again, states with under no uncertain terms that light, anything traveling at light speed, time stops. Or said in another way, time does not exist for the photon. So if you look at that, there's an obvious paradox, because at one moment we're measuring light at 186,000 miles per second, and at another time we have our world's greatest past physicist, as well as scientific experiments, proving that time does not exist for the photon. For this latter emphasis, we can think of the light wave as basically existing everywhere in the universe at once. Time does not exist for the photon, therefore it really has no speed. It can travel to the corners of the universe, and its clock never ticks. So literally, the photon is everywhere in the universe at once. So how does that, you know, how can you explain that with the corollary that we always measure light at 186,000 miles per second? The two, you know, are conflicting terms.
Well, at least the answer, intuitively, yes.
Yeah, exactly. Well, the answer to that is that waves are basically known as pure energy. They cannot be pinpointed in within time space. They are indeed, just like the light wave, everywhere. They have wave fronts that they spread out throughout the universe, and you can't pinpoint their location. So that's the wave. Now, somehow, whenever we as humans decide to measure a light wave or observe a light wave, there's something about our human interaction that causes the wave to basically collapse into a particle, and hence the term wave-particle collapse. So that's the conundrum we've always been faced with, and that's one reason that you never get two physicists agreeing on much of anything, let alone the Copenhagen interpretation. I tend to think it's very simple. Waves exist outside of time, and physics experiments back that up. Light particles, once they've collapsed, are existing within the realm of time, and that gives them this limited speed. And anyone who studies physics knows that time is inherent in the definition of speed. So the two make a lot of sense to me. The fact that waves exist outside of time, particles exist within time.
But then that also, Dr. Bauman, suggests that waves exist outside of space because time is a function of space, or
exactly.
Vice versa.
Exactly. Yeah, that's a very profound observation. I wish, I think most of your listeners, if they're familiar with Albert Einstein, know that he always talked about the time-space continuum.
And right.
That's exactly what you're speaking of. Now, there was another physicist by the name of Louis de Broglie who actually found, and again, scientific experiments support his findings, that every material particle has an associated wave, as bizarre as that may sound. In the scientific laboratory, physicists basically have to impart energy, usually in the form of heat, to get these small quantum particles to disassociate into their waveforms, but this has been done. And when they do this, they find that waves do all sorts of really bizarre things. There are some of the experiments, which your listeners can look up if they have interest. One goes by the name of the quantum eraser experiment. This is a series of experiments, one of which we will call experiment A, when the researchers actually made alterations to the end of the experiment, it caused changes to occur in the middle of the experiment. So let me say that again, because that really sounds nonsensical. But in the experiment, you had a beginning, a middle, and an end. The researchers actually altered the end of the experiment, and to their utter amazement, found that light in the middle of the experiment altered its behavior. In another quantum eraser experiment, very similar, instead of having a beginning, middle, and end, it had an upper and a lower arm in the experiment. And very similar to the first experiment, and I'll call this one a quantum eraser experiment B, when the researchers altered or made changes to the upper arm of the experiment, which had no connection at all to the lower arm of the experiment, they were actually able to show that light altered its behavior in the lower arm of the experiment. Again, very confusing, very complex experiments.
But if you dismiss the confusing, what do you imply from that, Dr. Bauman?
Well, I think most physicists, and certainly myself, find that light made basically retroactive changes within the experiment because it is not restricted or limited by the dimension of time like we are. So these experiments were actually observing light within its wave form, where light could actually go beyond the bounds of the dimension of time. Now, the final result of each experiment was actually measured or observed, which gave the researchers the various conclusions that they reached, but the results were always within measuring light as a particle, because, as I mentioned earlier, whenever the observational technique is introduced with a wave, it tends to cause this mysterious collapse, which is the whole philosophy and argument surrounding the Copenhagen interpretation. So that's this crazy quantum eraser series of experiments. And another phenomenon, which many of your listeners are familiar with, and I know you are, Eldon, is whenever we turn on computers and are using computers or our cell phones for prolonged periods of time, we notice they get warm. They can actually get hot. This is actually occurring within the processor of these electronic devices, and it results from a phenomenon known as tunneling, such as, a tunnel that we drive our car
right
through. Tunneling. What this phenomenon is that waves and particles, when they encounter an obstacle, they shouldn't be able to pass through an obstacle. Certainly, we humans know that. We're not able to walk through brick walls. But through this phenomenon of tunneling, we basically see electron waves and particles that are able to pass through barriers that they should not normally be able to pass through. And that creates the heat within the processors of our electronic devices. Obviously, I am going to argue, and many physicists would support me, that these electrons are able to pass or basically travel through the barrier, for lack of a better explanation, because they are able to do it as waves, where they can basically go around the barrier and magically appear on the other side. Again, once we measure or observe what's going on, we prevent this from happening because we reduce all of these waves to particles. So in a nutshell, that's what we're talking about with the wave-particle collapse. It's been mostly studied with light, but Louis de Broglie, for which he won a Nobel Prize, and many physicists would argue that this is possible with any material wave, which adds more to the bizarre nature of this whole phenomenon.
Do you think that that accounts for what, you know, some of this new research that is defining light as elastic?
Can you explain to me exactly what you mean by that?
Well, there's some new research that's going on right now in physics that is essentially showing that light is elastic in the sense that, using the word elastic in the sense that it can reach out like a rubber band, and it can also bounce back like that rubber band in that same waveform.
Right. That must be perhaps a lay term that various people have used to describe the nature of a wave where researchers cannot pinpoint where it is. And as an example, if you have this huge circular waveform of, say, a photon going out into outer space, if someone makes a measurement way over on one end of that waveform, you know, at the far edge of that circular front, it will basically cause that front to snap, so to speak, and condense into a point particle way at the, you know, wherever the observation was made. So you've basically got a wave which can be infinite in size, but as soon as a measurement or an observation is made, it is reduced to a point particle which can be precisely defined within the time-space continuum. So I think you could call that a snapping or an elasticity.
Yeah, I think, you know, I just quickly Googled it, and it's they're doing some work at University in Illinois, and it's a scattering of electromagnetic field, but that's a whole other subject. Let's leave that on. Tell me about the Einstein tree.
Oh, I love this story, so I'm glad you brought that up. Ernest Sternglass was a fellow physicist colleague of Einstein's, and he was interviewing Einstein one afternoon, and they were sitting outside discussing, you know, quantum physics and the Copenhagen interpretation, things that physicists do. And Ernest Sternglass said, you see that tree over there? Now turn your head away. Is it still there? And Einstein hated the concept that is defined by the Copenhagen interpretation, that if you are not looking at that tree in his yard, that basically physicists argue that the tree is not there. It goes back to that old story that many of us heard in grade school, that if a tree falls in the forest, you know, does it make a sound?
Right.
I know at that age, I thought that was a ridiculous question, and probably many people still do, but that is basically what the Copenhagen interpretation is saying, is that if there's no one around, does any of our material objects that we're so used to, you know, we experience on a day-to-day experience that do they really exist? And the Copenhagen interpretation would argue no. I would argue that in all simplicity, I think that what causes our materiality within our reality is the element of time. And that's what observation and measurement introduces, is it forces upon waves like Einstein's tree when it's not being observed. When we do observe it, it introduces the element of time, which causes the wave function collapse, and voila, you know, there it is. We can see
right.
It.
If you follow that, though, Dr. Bauman, Schrodinger's cat is, of course, what I think of whenever
sure.
you get into this kind of thing.
Exactly.
And I'm sure everybody's familiar with that. Once I've opened the door and I've determined the cat is alive or the cat is dead, okay?
Right.
Or I've seen the tree. Hasn't it then, and I'm going to use a very generic term here, hasn't it then distilled itself into reality and is no longer subject to collapse? It has collapsed, and it, as such, not going to turn back into a waveform?
I am with you completely, Eldon. I feel that that's why I feel Einstein, in so many respects, was correct, that you don't really need to observe the tree. There is something about human observation or the measurement process that once we introduce the element of time, it stays there until there is some catalyst which causes it to transform back into a wave. And, you know, we haven't reached that point to be able to identify what that is yet. We do know that we can take very small atoms, and actually in some laboratories they've even taken larger molecules, electrons as well, and when you apply heat and energy, you can actually get them to transform into waves. Now, whether energy is the key, like E equals mc squared, where E is the wave and m is the particle, you know, that is very possible. But we really haven't defined exactly what it is that causes particles to turn back into waves. We know that
right.
there's something about the observational process that does the reverse, that causes waves to transform to particles. But as you can see, it's pretty complex.
Right.
If I'm right, and it is this element and dimension of time, I think your listeners can appreciate we really still don't have a good handle on what time is. Many physicists don't believe that time even exists. So there we go back to physicists never agreeing.
Right.
But
I think intuitively, though, you have got that right.
Well, yeah, I mean, from an intuitive element, humans, you know, we're stuck within this dimension of time. So for us, it's real. And
yeah.
the only time we can experience it, to my way of thinking, is through dreams and a lot of paranormal activity, such as clairvoyance, the near-death experience and whatnot, where, you know, these people, they seem to lose the element of time.
But with time, and even with the equation E equals mc squared, what we have, I'm reminded of Heraclitus and his constant flux. Everything is in a constant flux. If that's the case, is there any such thing as a quantum zero?
Well, I think there probably is. Physicists have argued that before the Big Bang, I think there basically was a quantum zero, or at least that's what they're trying to convince us of, and that various phenomena known as quantum fluctuations caused the Big Bang to occur. Personally, I think it's just a term that they have applied to something that we don't know about and that we don't understand. But as science progresses, it does appear that even what we once thought were total vacuums of outer space are now believed to be seething, and I love the word seething, with activity. And perhaps dark matter and dark energy is part of that.
Yeah. You know, we had Rupert Sheldrake on the show not long ago, and in his work, Science Delusion, he challenges physics in a couple of ways. I mean, he challenges, of course, the notion of what we call our constants. He found someone who measures the speed of light, who admits to, you know, a history where the speed of light wasn't constant, where, you know, it seemed to change. But now they've redefined that by the length of a meter, so it has to always equal that.
Right.
But he also points out that dark matter is an invention of the mathematician in order to make equations fit. There is no evidence for dark matter outside of the necessity to fill in an unknown for the math to work. What's your take on that?
Oh, I completely agree. I mean, our take on dark matter is it's something which we have no idea what it is, but it's something which exerts a tremendous gravitational pull. Now, from our past Newtonian definitions of anything that causes gravity, you know, to occur, it's matter. So that's where the matter part comes in, and the dark part comes in that we just don't understand what type of matter it is.
Okay, but when you're explaining, you know, I mean, again, we create dark matter in order to make the equation fit that talks about gravity. Tie that into Higgs boson, because here we have. And now 99% of the physicists believe that the so-called God particle has been found. It is what forms space. So where are we there? Explain that.
Yeah, well, I wish I could, because I'm not sure the physicists fully understand. You know, if you go on Wikipedia, which gives a great explanation, they talk about how there's something known as the Higgs field. And that
right.
It's everywhere, and that out in outer space we have these things known as massless particles. When these particles, which again, perhaps it's dark matter, because, you know, most of us don't know what a massless particle is, because almost by definition, particles have some type of mass.
Right.
So when these massless particles encounter the Higgs field, they lose their momentum, and that lost energy is transformed into mass. And hence, the mass becomes this Higgs particle, or the God particle, which gives mass or matter, the quality of matter, to all particles.
Okay, we have about a minute left, Doc. And what
right.
I'd like you to do at this point is, you know, tie this together, if you can, in 1 minute. How does this suggest spiritual evidence to you?
For me, the fact that I came in to the 1970s being a atheist, because I did not believe in God. Science, to me, had convinced me there was not a need for a God. Quantum physics, the Copenhagen interpretation, when your readers really get into some of the nuances of this type of physics, they will find such supernatural elements which are inherent in the physics that, to me, it becomes difficult not to accept the reality of a higher intelligence and a supreme being. So that,
it's a great read, I'll tell you that.
Me. Well, thank you.
A great read. Medusa of Time, How Technology Redefines Copenhagen. Dr. Bauman, tell our audience how they can reach out to you, learn more about you, where to get your books.
Well, thank you, Eldon. Probably the easiest way is for them just to enter Lee Bauman, and that's Bauman, two N's at the end, on Google. One of the top three hits will be my Google page. And, you know, go to that. I have links to all of my books. And
all right. I'm sorry, but we're just out of time.
Certainly.
I want to thank the team at Hay House and our special guest and all of you for joining us today. I hope you enjoyed our show, and we'll join us again next week, same time and same place. And if you have comments on the show, do remember to let us know. Okay, until next time, wherever you are in the world, remember, believing in yourself always matters.